The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this July 15th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We're on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher. We are on other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we're doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these interesting days. We are going to do some literary thriller, psychological suspense, quantum physics, infidelity fiction this morning. Deborah Jo Immergut is with me for the full hour. Deborah Jo is the author of You Again, out this month and published by Echo HarperCollins. She's also the author of The Captives, a 2019 Edgar Award finalist for Best Debut Novel by an American Author, published by in the U.S. by Echo and in over a dozen other countries. She's also published a collection of short fiction. Private Property was published by Random House. Her essays and stories have appeared in American Short Fiction, Narrative, and the New York Times, among others. She's a recipient of the Michener and McDowell Fellowships. She has an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop and lives in Western Massachusetts. Deborah, welcome.
Thanks, Marie. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I really got a lot of enjoyment about listening to your sort of circuitous path into publishing. And you know, your start as a writer back at the University of Iowa and kind of what happened from there. And I thought, because we have the luxury of time this morning, that we could kind of start by walking through your origins as a writer and how all that happened. And then, you know, kind of how a little pause button got pushed and then you took off like a rocket ship.
Yes, it was maybe a kind of a big pause button, actually. So I have a long and winding journey through publishing, and I do love to talk about it because it's kind of a hopeful story, I think. I didn't really start writing fiction until I was out of college. I was a huge reader as a child and as a teenager, but you know, I didn't know any writers. That just didn't seem to be anything realistic that I could do. But when I graduated from college, I got into the magazine business, and I would sit at my desk in my entry-level job and edit copy. I happened to be working on a travel magazine, so these were writers traveling all over the world, and I thought, well, these people are having all the fun and I'm sitting here correcting their spelling. That doesn't seem right. So maybe I really ought to get serious and try to write. And I took a night class, really enjoyed it, and eventually applied to an MFA program. Actually, there weren't very many back then. This was in the late 80s. And so Iowa was the one that I had always heard about, and I applied there and got in. So that's really where it began. And so I went on, you know, having written maybe about three or four short stories in my life, while I was there, one thing that happens at the Iowa Writers Workshop is that agents will come visit and kind of troll for clients, for possible new clients. And so I met an agent there, and he gave me an offer of representation, which was unbelievable and exciting. Took my stories, the batch that I had at that point, maybe about six or seven, sold them to Random House, a very glamorous editor who worked there. And that was that. So I had to then finish the collection, write new stories, hand them in. And I kind of thought, all right, here I am, I'm on my way. It all seemed pretty smooth. So that story collection was Private Property, which you mentioned. It came out in 1992, I think, mm-hmm. or three. I can never quite remember. And I was so green. I was so inexperienced. I sort of thought, I think I had the notion that, you know, now I'm a writer and that's what I'll do for my job.
This is a fairy tale story. Yeah.
yes, but then it takes an interesting twist. And that is, you know, it came out, it got some nice notice, and then not a lot happened. And at that point in my life, I was living in Berlin with my boyfriend, who then became my husband. And we moved back to the States. I finally kind of finished a novel, which is generally what you're encouraged to do, I think, as a young short story writer, get that novel out there. It took me a while. I think one thing I didn't bargain on with that early publishing experience was how kind of exposed and vulnerable publishing can feel. And so, you know, that combined with my greenness, I think, and the fact that I truly just didn't, I haven't written that much in my life, made a novel hard.
Yeah.
But I did write, I was teaching in a women's prison. I had a really interesting experience there, and it inspired me to write this novel. I put it out there. At this point, it was the chick lit moment. Sex and the City was very popular. Mm. That was sort of what the marketplace wanted. And I handed in a novel set in a women's prison.
Not Orange is the New Black women's prison, but yes.
Exactly. Well, this was many years before that, right?
Right.
I actually remember being at a publishing party, and a very sort of prominent, high-powered woman in publishing asked me, she said, "Oh, you're a writer. What are you working on?" And I told her about this novel, and she said, "I mean, why in the world would anyone want to read this?" You know, So it was rough. And lo and behold, that novel was not accepted by a few places that my agent sent it to. And I think at that point, I was pregnant. I was in need of money. I took a full-time job, and I said, let's just put this writing thing aside for a while. And that, so that's sort of where I landed as a young writer, feeling quite frustrated, a little bit shut out, like what I was offering wasn't so much in demand. And I know that is not an uncommon feeling for writers to have. So I spent quite a lot of time in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the meantime, I got huge satisfaction out of being a mother. I went back into the magazine business and had some good jobs, wonderful colleagues, and life went on, you know. Mm-hmm. But the writing called me back, and I knew it would. I knew it would. Somehow I sensed I just needed to do it when the time was right. So eventually I did get back to it as my son got a little bit older and life eased up a little bit. I joined a writing group that met one night a week, and I kept writing.
You know, it's interesting. The thing writers I feel like are always told is don't look at the marketplace. Don't, you know, whatever is going on out there has no bearing on what you should be working on. You should be writing the novel that, you know, kind of calls to you. Mm-hmm. And I still think that's true. I still think that's really good advice. But as I'm listening to you say that, did you come out of that experience sort of feeling like it was still, The Captives was still my novel to write? It just wasn't the right time for it. And, you know, the timing has to meet the work, but that you should not, like, in retrospect, would you have ever tried to write a Sex in the City novel back then? Or it's just not your wheelhouse, right?
That was just not my wheelhouse. Yeah. And I felt, I think I just felt overall that maybe this, the difficulty of the path, I just didn't have the right equipment for it. Like for that challenge and climb, somehow I sensed I wasn't, I don't know, there was a mismatch between my desires and the realities of the publishing world at that point. And yeah, I didn't think I could deliver a Sex and the City novel.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I think that's really true. I often, you know, I'm sure in the writing world, you've heard people say, you know, maybe non-writers will say to you, why don't you just write, you know, a murder mystery and it'll be a bestseller, right? And you know, you think, no, I mean, the people who write those best-selling murder mysteries do that because that's their passion and their love and their skill. And you can't just fabricate that. Yeah. There's no way.
Yeah. Right, right. Absolutely. Go ahead.
So, but, you know, the great, what I found was time did eventually catch up with me and I kind of caught up with myself. So when I, you know, when I was a bit older, a bit tougher, I went back to my work in a serious way. And one of the things I did was take that prison novel out of the drawer. And in fact, it wasn't in a drawer. It was on a floppy disk. That was, it's such an outmoded technology that I had to have this techie friend of mine get it off the floppy disk so that I could use it on my, you know, on my laptop, my MacBook Air, and he did. And so I rewrote it and that got a new agent and that sold in 2 days and that became The Captives.
Oh my God, it sold in 2 days. Wow. Isn't that funny? How they say, you know, it's an overnight success with, you know, 25, 30 years behind it. I love those stories. Well, and it sounds like, would you say that the MFA experience was as important or less important than the life experience? Because, you know, the work in women's prisons, obviously, just, you know, living through life, becoming a mother, living in Berlin, all of these things feel like that's what adds the depth and texture to writing as opposed to the classroom experience.
Oh, well, in my case, there's no doubt that I feel now at this life stage that I have this deep well of experience and material to draw from and sort of a maturity and a toughness, like I said. So that is hugely helpful. Now, some writers come out of the gate with that. The MFA was helpful in that I think it was the first time I was able to take myself seriously as a writer. Mm-hmm. And I worked with amazing people at Iowa, Francine Prose, Alan Gerganis, Madison Smart Bell, Elizabeth Talent are some of the writers, James Allen McPherson, T.C. Boyle. Those were all teachers that I had. One thing I think that was true in that era of the 1980s, that has changed is they didn't really focus on preparing you. I mean, it was sort of, I think back in those days, there's still a sense that you can't teach that much to an MFA student. You sort of put them through the meat grinder, give them some critiques, you know, see who's got talent and who doesn't, kind of sort the wheat from the chaff. I think MFA programs now do a much better job of preparing young writers for the world of publishing, and they focus more on craft. And I know, you know, you, Marie, in this podcast focus a lot on craft, which is why I enjoy listening to it. Craft, I don't even remember that term being used back in those days. I think that we, you know, I think that's because of the proliferation of these programs and people teaching in them, there's a sort of, you know, refinement of the language that I think must be helpful. But, yeah. You know, back in Iowa was just a little bit of a meat grinder. It really was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had heard you talk, there's a great interview that you did with the Millions maybe a year or two ago. And you were talking about how the MFA program didn't really focus on the reader's experience and it didn't really focus on plot or book construction. It more, by the way you were talking about it, sounded like it focused more on beautiful sentences and, you know, all dressed up and no place to go, you know, that the you know, it was more a minute critique as opposed to a global, how does a book sort of fit together critique. And I think that's the hard part of novels. And that's obviously what this novel we're going to talk about today really excels at, is it's a really complicated plot structure. And if you're not getting that from an MFA, that'd be tough. I don't know how you learn or teach yourself that.
Well, I don't know either, but I teach myself. And, you know, part of the reason is with Iowa was that we were very focused on the short story. And so we never talked about novel construction. I didn't take a single class in writing a novel. So whatever I have gleaned, I have sort of figured out on my own by close reading, and trial and error, lots and lots of error.
Well, yeah, a lot of close reading. You're right. I mean, writer after writer says the best education is reading, reading, reading. And yeah, you would get a sense over, you know, hundreds of novels of how a novel is put together. But that is probably the best way to do it. The most painful way to do it, but probably the best way to do it. You are tuned into Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Deborah Jo Immergut, and we are about to talk about you again. I want to dive into the book, and then we can kind of use the book as a way to talk about all these kind of crafty questions. No one can introduce a book as well as the author can, but I loved your earlier description. When you were in the process of writing it, you talked about it as, you know, infidelity meets quantum physics meets social injustice meets psychological thriller. I was like, that's pretty good. I wouldn't know what to make of that if I hadn't read the novel, but that's a pretty good description of it. But I'll let you take us into it. Talk about Abigail and you again, and then we can use it as our way to jump off into the talk.
Okay. Well, you know, this novel came to me one day when I was pushing my son in his stroller down a street in New York City where I just hadn't been in years. And so I've told a little bit of my backstory there. So you might be able to understand this story a little bit better, yep. Which is that I'm pushing a stroller along. I happen to be, I find myself on a block where I had lived when I was 22. And at this point I was in my mid 30s, maybe pushing toward 40. And I came to this building, the shabby 5-floor tenement building where I had lived when I was 22. And nothing changed. It's one of these parts of Greenwich Village that really is pretty unchanged. And, you know, I just had the strangest sensation that I could see the door opening and that girl walking out. And then I thought she'd look at me, she'd look at this mom with the stroller, and I wondered what she would say. What would she think? What would she say? And, I went on my way, but that image really stuck with me, haunted me, and I basically started writing the story as soon as I could to figure out what she would say, to hear her talk to me. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was afraid that she was going to say to me at this point, this was in the middle of that long stretch when the pause button was on my writing, and I thought she would say, where the hell is that novel?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Why are you not doing this? And it was, you know, it was a question, honestly, I was asking myself all the time. So was sort of out of all of that kind of roiling emotion that this book was born. And it is about Abigail Willard. She is a working mother in New York City, and she is haunted by her 22-year-old self. They meet continually. It's sort of in the old haunts, the Abigail's old haunts from that time, the few remaining places that haven't changed in New York. And through that, you know, Abby is really forced to question a lot of her choices. And I think that's pretty universal for people at certain stages of their life, where you kind of get a vantage point where you can really see back and you really find yourself confronting the what ifs.
Yeah. I'm glad you made that autobiographical observation on my behalf, because I always kind of hate talking to writers about, oh, you can really see yourself in this novel. A, because, you know, who cares? And it's not, it's nobody's business how much is autobiographical. But in this case, it was so satisfying to say, oh, you can really see how this novel would have come about, that really must have been on your mind as you had, you know, kind of these two stages of your writing life, this early whirlwind kind of success, and then, you know, like you say, this long pause, and then much later burst of success. Maybe you don't feel it's a burst of success because it was out there for a long time, but yeah, you can really see the origins of where this came from. Do you feel like that original kernel of your idea, like as you look at the novel now as a finished product, did it stay pretty true to that original vision that you had, or did it surprise you in some of its twists and turns and how it ended up in the end?
It absolutely surprised me. And, you know, that to me is very essential in writing a novel, because damn, it takes a long time, and you know, and it is such hard work. So if there's not some fun storytelling happening, you know, where your characters are talking to you, surprising you, and taking you to places you wouldn't have expected, then, you know, I think it would just be such a slog. So, absolutely. I had no idea. I mean, that is sort of a crazy scenario, right? You know, meeting your younger self. I had no idea why this would be happening, how it could be possible, and where it would take me, or, you know, in this case, in Abigail. So, you know, I started with just huge question marks, but just feeling compelled to try and force this story forward and draw it out to some conclusion. You know, if a woman were to meet her younger self, talk to her, how would that unfold? And it, you know, and where would it, and of course it begs questions such as, would your present life change if you started mixing in with your past life? There's that whole Star Trek sort of question.
Right. Yes.
Which I had to contend with. And then, of course, you know, what about the other people in her life, and how would they, you know, react when they find out about this scenario? Are they going to think she's out of her mind? Are they going to commit her? Or, you know, so endless questions. Almost no answers. That was through the writing that I found them.
So it seems like it would be a novel that was very heavily edited, because as you say, as you're going down this path, it would open up more questions than you would have answers to. And then it would force you, you know, into certain plot points that would be, you would almost have to heavily, do you like outline after you're done with it? Like, do you see all the material that's out there and then backwards outline, or do you outline it kind of as you go along? Because it's, you know, after I finished it, going back and looking at how it's constructed, it, you know, it has to be really carefully constructed. So talk a little bit about that process. If you wrote it kind of beginning to end, and then, you know, how you figured out the structure from there, because it looks very hard.
Well, I think one of the keys that I've discovered in my return to novel writing and is that I need a very strong and very simple premise that is packed with inherent energy. And I think this is something that I, you know, maybe we don't talk about enough as writers, is you know, premise. So with You Again, I had this premise, this image of a woman meeting and confronting her younger self. That seemed packed with inherent energy, and that energy can take me through a lot of the first draft. Even if I feel lost a lot of the time, I'm kind of drawing from that stored up energy, the dynamic that's in that premise. And it's pushing me along. It's a bit messy. There's a lot of loose ends. And so, yes, you're right that then the later drafts are, you know, absolutely key and essential for smoothing it out, weaving in some other plot elements that help explain and clarify. And it's sort of like shaking, you know, I think of like the old process of developing film where you're shaking that in the developer, you're shaking and shaking that tray and it starts to emerge. And those later drafts, I'm shaking that tray. I'm seeing what areas need work and going back to them. But really, for me, the premise, if it's really strong, can, you know, and I'm saying sort of strong to me, you know, other people may judge the premise differently, but for me, it has to have that energy. And I just use it as another example, the captives, because I think this has just become central to me. And as I think about my next work, I've spent a lot of time on it too. So the captives is about, you know, basically a high school reunion that happens in the confines of a prison, a correctional facility. And there's a man who works as this a psychologist in the prison and an inmate who he is assigned to treat, who he realizes is, you know, instantly he recognizes her as his high school crush, the woman that, you know, he was obsessed with as a teenage boy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was a girl. So anyway, that seemed to me a premise. There's all sorts of dynamics in that scenario that were very inspiring and helped me get through that story and pull a story out of it. So that to me is really the key. And then, yes, the revisions to help you smooth out all those many rough edges and loose ends.
I love that you made that comment about the premise, because I feel like that's also a really good way for a writer to key in on what's serving the story and what isn't. Because when I finished this, I realized I didn't really know much about Abigail's life pre-22. You know, I didn't know how she grew up so much. I didn't know where she grew up. And then I realized, who cares? You know, it's not serving the story. It doesn't really have anything to do with the forward momentum. And I think that's where a lot of writers get lost is... you know, they just start throwing in the kitchen sink because they don't understand this early process of premise. And I love that you frame it that way, that everything that would then come back to is this answering that question. I think that's a really helpful way to look at it. And, you know, what is necessary to include and then what, you know, is extraneous and not necessary. So that's really helpful. I remember you talking about in The Captives also, for those characters that you had sort of two opposing desires in the character and how that both illuminates character and at the same time creates plot, creates tension. And I was thinking that that was true in this novel as well. I mean, anytime you have infidelity between husband and wife, it's both revealing of character, revealing of relationship and instant tension. And I was wondering if that sort of thinking in The Captives, if you pulled that into this novel and worked with that idea as well of how to reveal character while advancing plot.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the Captives is it was called a two-hander, which is a term, you know, that I think comes from the movies. Possibly, but you know, it's two characters, this you know, this man and this woman who I've described, and this shifting dynamic between them, who's got the upper hand, you know, as the story goes along. This is how, you know, that informs the plot and really creates the plot, and that dynamic, I found that really fascinating to work with and helpful. Again, you're so right that so much of novel writing is deciding what to leave out. So, you know, that dynamic is absolutely the center and helped me kind of move the story along. And I do love a streamlined novel. One day I want to write a big sprawler, but right now I'm into streamlined. So that helps. And character to me definitely is a plot driver, you know, that it should be the main plot driver. So the character's choices as they face and, you know, confront the various forces that are arrayed against them, that is where our plot comes from. And sometimes, you know, they make choices that thwart our expectations. And that's sometimes how, you know, that's where surprise comes in. That's where twists might come in. So yes, I definitely believe, a character has a strong desire. They have, there are forces that threaten or thwart those desires. And so then they force the character to make choices. And that's where, to me, plot comes from. To boil it down to, a really oversimplification. But again, it's one of those things that helps you prune.
Right, right. Tell me a little bit about working with a character who started out autobiographically when the seed, the kernel for her was you. I've talked to a lot of writers who say writing biographically close characters is really difficult. And, you really have to find that break where the person, your character is no longer associated with you at all to be able to work with them. And I was wondering about that process for you, about, really making the distinction between Abigail and Deborah, I assume would have had to happen pretty early on. I don't know, but, talk a little bit about whether that was tricky when she kind of came out of you. I'm trying to think of that Greek mythical character where the person pops out of the person's head, but they have to be separate and distinct from you.
Yes. I sometimes think of writing as method acting. So, where the director will come up to the child actor and sort of whisper, and, the child has to cry and the director will whisper, like, think about your dog, dying, and the child will be able to cry. I think that that's a little bit how it works for me. So while there are certain elements of you, again, that are so close to my story, a lot of it I'm just using the emotions of, for example, thwarted creative drive, which I lived with for quite a long time, or maybe it's just sort of unused creative drive, and how that can be painful and that can, cause a lot of inner turmoil. And so I just draw on that emotion to give the story as much truth as I can. And I feel like, that's the basis for all great art, right? It's true. It's truth. It's the artist's truth, right?
Yep.
Then the lying part, the fabrication part is the fun and the craft and where, pure imagination comes in. So, so there's, I guess it's just like, if there's those two layers. So, Abigail is not me. And she does things that I would never dream. I mean, she, not to give too much away, but she's driven to extremes in her behavior that I would never dare, but how right. fun to be able to do it, in her shoes. And so that's part of why we do this, I think. And it's also why I find nonfiction a real struggle. And I have written essays. I really could never imagine writing a memoir, like a book length piece of nonfiction, because I love to lie about the circumstances and absolutely make things up. That's the license that we have as fiction writers, and I love to use it.
Yes, yes, yes. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Deborah Jo Immergut, and the book is You Again. Yes, I mean, we often talk about how many more truths you can tell through fiction than you can tell through nonfiction, and how you can get to the emotional truth of things in better, easier ways through fiction, and that certainly is the fun. So one of the subplots of the book was Abigail's son gets involved with Antifa. I don't think I'm giving too much away here, but I thought it was, interesting what the book, the world the book is being born into, where Antifa is back in our news cycle. I don't know how much of that you could have anticipated when you were writing this. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about whether you feel like the world as it is now is shedding new light, commentating in a different way on Antifa and the way you were thinking about it at the time you were writing it, or if it really has no kind of bearing on the book, or, you know, like if you're viewing the book in a different way now in light of current discussions?
Well, I will say my interest in Antifa goes back a very long way to my days in Berlin in the 90s when, you know, Antifa has its roots in European anti-fascism before, during, and after World War II. And it's taken a lot of different permutations over the years. And I'm absolutely no expert in it. But when I was in my 20s in Berlin, I saw these people my own age, dressed in black, on the street. Every year on May Day, which is like the International Workers' Day, there was sort of this ritualistic fighting between the police and the Antifa in certain streets and certain parks. And it was almost this kind of street theater. And, you know, it was just like a fabric of that sort of crazy time in Berlin. And it was fascinating to me as a 20-something who grew up in an era like this sort of Reagan, Clinton, Bush era, where there was not a lot of street brawling of any kind. So anyway, it caught my eye. I never really forgot about them. And then when the Trump era dawned and I was really beginning to think about you again, the Antifa actually showed up here, and I really again caught my eye because I remembered them from Berlin. And so they came out on Inauguration Day in Washington, D.C. It was not much. There was like a few of them. I think famously, they burned a limousine, they broke a window at a Starbucks, and I think it was an Antifa person who punched this neo-Nazi guy, and, you know, that went all over the internet. And it sort of made me wonder, oh, are we, you know, and with everything that kind of came in with the Trump inauguration, and how people were feeling and the extremes that we were seeing, whether Antifa would really take hold here. And, you know, it has been here in small ways for years. So anyway, that was in my mind. I had this teenage character, Abigail's son, who's 16, Pete. And you know, underlying Abigail's story and the book is, you know, a lot of my feelings about being a cog in a corporate wheel. I worked in some very large corporations over the years in my paycheck jobs, which I was extremely grateful to have, by the way, and felt proud and, you know, that I could put food on the table and a roof over my family's head. However, I always felt constrained. Mm-hmm. I never liked sitting in a cubicle, which I spent many years doing. And I felt at some level the dehumanizing forces at work there. And so, you know, this is a political underpinning to this, you know, novel of suspense. It's in there, but it's also just very personal memory to me that sometimes I felt pretty disheartened by what it felt like to be a tiny cog in a big wheel in this society. So that informs Abigail, and Pete kind of bounces off of that, I think, and gets himself involved in this wild band of Antifa in Brooklyn. And this is in 2015. So they would have been like a small cell, which there were, you know, all over the US even then. And so we've seen them grow. And I think we've seen them grow because of everything that's been going on in our society. And because, you know, extremism has grown. And then, you know, okay, so come up to this last few months, I totally did not anticipate that Antifa would burst back into the news in this way.
Right.
And I've talked to, you know, friends who are involved in Black Lives Matter and care, you know, and about, well, you know, because I wanted to understand, what are you thinking about Antifa being out there on the streets now? And by the way, I'm sitting in a small rural town in Massachusetts where I'm not seeing anything really close up. And, you know, I think that they feel that it is, you know, maybe a distraction, that it's not all that helpful. And And I think that's fascinating and interesting. And it also jives a little bit with my attitude toward them in the book, which I hope you could see is sort of a little bit skeptical, right?
Right.
While also respecting the passion and the frustration of, you know, that is being manifested here, you know, and yet, you know, your tactics, you question them and you feel that some of them, and I know from reading about Antifa and just having a sense of it from talking to people that, you know, it does attract a lot of like boys who just want to smash things, you know, and really don't care that much about politics. So all of that is in there. And I try to explore all the dimensions of a movement like that.
All of that is in there. And that's why I thought it was just so interesting how your own subconscious psychology as a writer bubbles up and meets the present day moment. And how often that happens in fiction and how interesting it is when it does happen. And, you know, the world the book is born into is a different world than the book was written in. And how often synchronicity just, you know, gives it a little, I don't know, wormhole push or something. It's really, that was just really interesting to me. Was it a lot of research on your part? I mean, there's a little bit of quantum physics in here to explain things. Was there a lot of research that went into the book?
Yes, there was a fair amount. When I, you know, came up with this premise, this older self meets younger self premise, I told myself, well, your challenge is, and you must accept it, you have no choice but to accept that you must present some possible explanations for what's going on with Abigail here. You may not say, and then she woke up and it was all a dream.
So, right.
Which I despise, right? And yep. Most people do. So, And so I wanted to present the reader with some plausible explanations to mull. I wanted to try to have multiple strands going and then in the end leave mystery. So plausible explanations, but plenty of mystery too, so that it doesn't feel over-explained, over-determined and too pat. So that's where the research came in. Basically, there's a physicist who, we have some other voices that are looking at Abigail's situation from the vantage point of 1 year after the events of the book, the main story. And so we have a physicist, a psychologist is in there, and then a forensic neurologist. So there's some brain science. And you know, all of that required a certain amount of research, reading, talking to people. But my favorite research was going to artist studios because Abigail is a painter and I really wanted to get that part right. I'm kind of a would-be visual artist. I have many artist friends. I've always been, you know, just enthralled by visual arts. So I really wanted to get inside the mind of a visual artist as accurately as I could and really do justice. I knew I would hear about it from my friends if I didn't. Right. So I got into their studios, smelled their paints and looked at the beautiful chaos and that they have there and which I've always loved being around and just did my best to evoke that. That was the best research.
That would be fun. Yeah, that would be fun. What were the sticking points? Like, was there a time when you just didn't know how to get out of a particular situation and without giving out too much away about the novel, but I'm just wondering, you know, not writer's block, but just writing yourself into a corner and figuring out how to get yourself out of it.
Yes. Well, I sometimes say that this novel broke my brain and it was the hardest brain work I've ever done. It is about a brain. So maybe my own brain was kind of in rebellion against going so deep into thinking about how this other woman's brain was working for her and against her. But, you know, I think the whole time-space continuum question of, well, if Abigail is developing this relationship with her younger self, trying to give her advice and perhaps steer her away from mistakes. And yet, of course, she has these beautiful, two beautiful sons, teenage sons. She has a marriage, a good job, a house, and she does not want to destroy her life. So, and yet she is so compelled to interact with this young woman, who, by the way, we are often not sure who this young woman actually is. And is she really younger Abigail? And that's one of the questions that kind of dances throughout. And I hope I, kind of keep that ball in the air a bit. But she's compelled to go back to this woman. And yet she also understands at some level she could be endangering everything. So that was a tricky, tricky problem for the writer.
Super tricky. And, as I went back to read it after finishing it, the ways you did that through punctuation, quotation marks, no quotation marks, very clever use of names, all these little things that you did that on first pass through may have gone a little bit unnoticed by the reader, and on second pass through was very intentionally, creatively, artfully done by you. That's, I guess, that motivated my question earlier, which is this had to have been really carefully, plotly constructed. But I assume a lot of those decisions about the artful use of quotation marks, the artful use of names, all of these things were things that happened in revision when your brain apparently was breaking.
Yes, a lot of that did. But I will say that, older Abigail, or let's say, I like to call her present day Abigail. Present day Abigail is talking with younger Abigail and seeing her and meeting her. It's told always in present tense. That actually just happened as I was writing the first draft. I didn't even realize that I was doing that. But every time she glimpses this young woman, the narrative shifts into a present tense. The rest of it is, told in the form of Abigail's journal entries. So she's writing mostly in past tense, but when she starts writing about, I see her, I see her in the plaza at Rockefeller Center, I see this young woman again, there she is. It starts to come out in present tense, and that was just how it evolved. So that was not even a conscious decision, but many of the others were the result of lots and lots of tinkering, tweaking, and thinking about how to handle some of the difficulties of these multiple time strands.
I'll say it again. Isn't it great when your subconscious is smarter than your conscious mind? That it makes these decisions and you're like, yep, that's correct. That's how it should be. That's great. That's great. Did you have, so you had this writing group back in the day. Is a novel like this, like, how do you put that through a critique group? Because it feels like this would have to be something that's looked at kind of all in one swoop to be helpful. I mean, I know they would know it over time, but talk a little bit about readers for your work and how you use them and if the writing group is still serving you and kind of how all that stuff works.
Well, have you ever heard of the Amherst writers and readers method? I think that's what it's called. There's a style of writing group that is very popular in this part of the world, which I'm talking from Western Massachusetts, which is, I'm very close to Amherst College. So a lot of groups around here are run in this way where we get together. And by the way, I'm not in one right now, but back when I was beginning this novel, I would go once a week. You get together for an hour and a half or 2 hours and write together. And then you read what you've just written. And the rule is you can't read, and you read it aloud to the group. So you can't read anything that you've been working on and tinkering with. It's always first draft work. Mm-hmm. And then the rule is that only positive feedback is allowed because it is just born first draft, freshly minted. And it's a wonderful thing for working people who want to write on the side because you have a dedicated couple of hours a week that you can count on that you're going to get words on page and get encouragement. And I actually wrote 180 pages of the first draft that way. So, and I will say, like, my group, they were into it. And I, you know, the first scene that I wrote in that living room is pretty much the same first scene from the novel all these years later. And when I read it aloud, I knew I had something and I had that premise that I just could feel the reaction in the room that this might be something universal and relatable and suspenseful. So so that's really how that functioned. I am a huge believer in community. It was really how I found my way back to the work after my years in the wilderness, was writing with other people in that way. And now I have a one dear friend, writing partner, who I exchange work with. And she does the more what you're talking about with exchanging, kind of tracking the novel, reading chapters, and giving me sort of more intensive feedback. And that's also been super helpful. But I think I tried on my own for many years, not that successfully. And once I started writing in a community, it's just changed my life. And I so enjoy it. I also teach, and I find that piece of community wonderful too, and feeds me.
I was going to ask if there are other things that feed you, and if you read sort of, I don't even know what the genre you're writing is. It's a pretty unique cross-genre thing, but if you, you know, immerse yourself in that, or if you really try to stay away from it when you're working on the work to, you know, kind of give yourself distance, or if you lean in. And sometimes even teaching also strikes me as something that could either be a distraction or you know, maybe a fountain of inspiration.
I think teaching has really helped me crystallize my thinking about complicated things like plotting, and you know, how I've sort of stumbled and learned by trial and error. And then, you know, now when I teach a class in plotting, I really have to be able to explain what I'm doing. And that's helped me enormously. So that feeds me, plus just the energy of working with aspiring writers at all levels, I really enjoy. As far as reading, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you're not quite sure how to classify my work. And I think that's absolutely spot on. It's, I seem to be working along a sort of a ridge line. I'm like walking a ridge line between this sort of thriller suspense novel and literary fiction. And I think I'm doing that fairly intentionally because I definitely come from a literary fiction background, and that's my DNA, and my short story collection is very, very literary and influenced by the short story writers who were big when I was coming up. But, you know, I have become very enamored by a fast moving plot and a lot of incident. And I think that's where I've sort of strayed into the thriller and suspense world, and I kind of enjoy it. But honestly, I read more on the literary side, but I have a couple of real heroes in the thriller world, and John Le Carré would be number one. Because I think he's a master at creating character and having the character drive the plot, not to mention just a beautiful writer. So I really look to him in the thriller world. But when I think about novel construction, I'm really looking at Toni Morrison. Beloved is a huge touchstone. Ian McEwan. He's somebody, he's a real role model because he does do plot, really plots, and his premises are always interesting and amazing and full of energy. So he's a big one for me.
Yes.
And I think Kate Atkinson is another writer who novelist I love and look to as a model. Mm. She thinks she does it really well. And she writes some mysteries, some thrillers, and some literary fiction. And so that's sort of, you know, the world that I'm looking toward.
Yeah, that's a good library. That's a good library. Before we have to sign off, I'd also love to hear kind of how, if you feel like this moment in history, I talk to so many writers who are just not able to work right now. And, or, you know, the outside noise is really complicating their inner quiet creativity time. And I was curious about how you're dealing with the last several months, last 6 months or so. And if you feel like this is a time, you know, that's maybe not inspiring right now, but will someday be inspiring, or, you know, how you're kind of giving yourself permission to work in the last little bit here.
Well, I think what's been really difficult is that I am trying to write, and I'm doing okay at that. I'm, you know, in some ways it's a refuge. But what's really difficult is putting this novel out at this moment of terrible news and just incredible upheaval and really important discussions in our society and that need to happen and really do need to be put at the center stage right now. So to be putting my work out at this moment is challenging. It's hard to know how to feel celebratory, which of course you want to feel after the many years of work that you've put into your art. But it is a very conflicted feeling at the moment, I have to admit. So I'm just, you know, you hope that you are doing your part to provide something of meaning and maybe a little bit of beauty, a little bit of solace, but really it's pretty hard. And I guess one thing I would say is, you know, with all the loss that we're feeling right now, all the rage that we're feeling right now, it definitely puts the writer's struggle into perspective.
Right.
You know, and you know, authors complain a lot and we feel a lot. It's not an easy road sometimes, but you know, and I'm sure all, you know, your listeners know rejection is a part of it and all of those things that can get us down, but really this, our moment right now puts it into perspective. It's such a gift to be able to do this work, and any time that I have quiet and calm and space to sit and write, I'm so grateful for in this world.
Yeah. Well, that was going to answer my last question, which is, you're right, putting a book out in this environment. I so feel for writers right now who, especially debut novelists who, you know, this was everything they've been working for. I guess the good side of it is that there are opportunities to bring the community together across the world to some of these events. You know, I've been able to go to more events in many ways than I was before because they're all online, and you know, that's kind of fun in certain ways and a welcome escape from, you know, the daily news.
And I will say authors who are publishing this year have banded together in a beautiful way. I'm part of a group called Lockdown Literature, which really was born out of the idea of a writer, Mary South, and a few others who were coming out in the spring and just felt kind of lonely and isolated. And what are we going to do? This is an unprecedented moment and our books are dropping. And so they got together and it's sort of to console one another. And it's blossomed into a group of, I don't know, 80 or so writers, maybe more, who are coming out during these months and just trying to boost each other a little bit, boost our spirits, you know, maybe boost our social media by sharing each other and cheering each other on. And that's been fantastic. And there's a few other ventures like that have sort of come out of the writing community.
That is fantastic. That is fantastic. And your website, you have a great website. Your name, is it Deborah Jo Immergut, the whole name.com?
Deborah Jo Immergut.com.
Yes, perfect. Deborah, thanks so much for taking the time. This was such a pleasure.
Thank you, Marie. It was an honor.
That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.